This is an interview with Henry Manny for the SEC Historical Society's Virtual Museum and Archive on the History of Financial Regulation. I'm James Stoker. Today is August 6, 2012. We're talking at Professor Manny's home in Naples, Florida. Professor Manny, thanks for having me here today.
It's a pleasure to be with you, James.
To start off, where were you born and where did you grow up?
I was born in New Orleans and grew up from the age of four in Memphis. Went through public schools in Memphis, went to college in Tennessee at Vanderbilt, and after college I left the South, went to the University of Chicago Law School and then Yale Law School for an SJD.
Mm-hmm. Okay, just to go back a little bit, was either of your parents a lawyer?
No. My father was a merchant and my mother worked with him.
As a young man, did you plan on having a career in law?
No. As a matter of fact, like many people, even today, I think, it was sort of all that was left after I had excluded doing everything else. I went to law school.
Were you an avid reader when you were young?
Well, I wouldn't say avid, but I was a good student, mm-hmm. and that meant reading. Memphis in the 30s and 40s had a superb public education system for the white population. I can't attest to what it was for the poor blacks. And it was totally segregated, of course, which was one of the reasons I was anxious to leave the South. but the education was very good. I don't think that quality of public school exists anywhere today.
Mm-hmm. Would you say that you had any early influences, either literary or philosophical, that strike you as important?
Well, in my family background, of course, were merchants. As was common, my great-grandfather had been a peddler, as was not uncommon with Jewish immigrants, and had founded a store in a small country town, New Madrid, Missouri. And I rather grew up in a commercial environment. I understood what retailing was about, what marketing was about. As I once said jokingly, in law school I was perhaps the only person in my class the first year who had ever seen a bill of lading. So that there was a little bit of that in my background, but I nothing very specific that I can point to.
Would you have described yourself at the time as either a conservative or libertarian?
Oh, no. I was. I think you would describe me then by then the standards then as a radical leftist. I went to law school at the University of Chicago thinking I would become a labor lawyer. I was certainly not by modern standards a radical at all, but Henry Wallace campaign appealed to me very much in those days.
At Vanderbilt, you majored in economics. Why?
It's a very interesting question and will have a surprising answer for you. When I went to Vanderbilt, I started in the summer of 1946 with the gigantic inroad into universities of veterans on the GI Bill. Vanderbilt at that time had double its pre-war enrollment and half its pre-war faculty. It was, to put it mildly, a mess. The departments weren't organized, courses weren't available, nothing was straight. By my last year there, I completed the 4 years in 3 years of summer with summer work, they had managed to get one department working again, and that was economics. And it was clear that it was it had acquired some very good faculty and organized the program and so forth. And that was one of the reasons I majored in economics. Mm-hmm. So it was an accident. On the other hand, it was an economics professor from the University of Chicago who strongly suggested that mm-hmm. I go to the law school at the University of Chicago.
You said you attended college on the GI Bill?
I didn't.
Oh, you didn't personally. Okay.
I was not a veteran right. at that time.
Mm-hmm. You were too young probably for military
service. That's right. I missed it by 1 year. Mm-hmm. But all the World War II veterans, that was the peak of the GI Bill population right. in colleges.
Okay. When did you decide to go to law school?
I guess in my last year in college. again, as I said, because I really couldn't think of anything else to do. I really wanted to, at that point, get a PhD in economics, and I was terribly insecure about the education that I had gotten. And I really thought you had to be advanced to enter a PhD program. Well, that wasn't true, but I didn't know it, and went to law school.
Did you expect to practice law after graduating?
I already at that time had some aspirations for teaching. And I knew enough to know that law teaching was a possibility after a short time after finishing law school.
Okay, so why the University of Chicago?
Well, I mentioned that a professor who was a considerable influence on me, Roland McKean, later very distinguished at the University of Virginia and UCLA, had recently gotten his PhD at Chicago. He knew Aaron Director, who was the economist in the law school who was so influential in the development of law and economics. He knew Milton Friedman. And I was very attracted to him and the work in economic theory that I was doing with him. Became friendly with him. He was a mentor. He suggested that I would like Chicago, and he was right.
Did you realize at the time that the University of Chicago Law School was a relatively unique place?
No. Almost no one realized it because it wasn't even a gelled fact at that time. Aaron Director had gone there only 1 or 2 years before. He went there, I believe, in 47. I went there in 49. Now, in 2 years, an enormous influence had been felt in the law school from economics through Aaron Director, but it wasn't widely known. Certainly, Professor McKean, whom I was referring to, had no sense that there was anything developing like a comprehensive economic analysis of law. No one had any full idea of how you'd integrate law and economics. It was just that new.
Mm-hmm. Would you tell me about some of the courses that you took at the University of Chicago Law School?
Well, interestingly, a first-year required course was price theory. that was an accident, a hangover from an old Hutchins program that gave an accelerated BA and JD and included some non-law courses in the law school. A very distinguished economist, Henry Simons, had taught that course in the law school. He died, I believe, in 1946, and that was when Director went there to take it over. The price theory course was, I believe, unusual. It was the same course that Frank Knight taught in the college at the University of Chicago. It was a comprehensive course that really plumbed sort of the philosophic depths of economics more than many price theory courses do. And, you know, you go to law school as a naive student not knowing what's given. I assumed that a course in economics was not a totally unusual thing to have in law school.
Mm-hmm. To your knowledge, was there any other law school in the country that offered a similar course?
Nothing similar. There are known to be a couple of efforts to use economists in law schools, both of which were unsuccessful. One was an economist named Hale at Columbia. He apparently influenced no one. Nothing ever came of that, though I think he was rather distinguished economist. The other was, I'm going to forget the name, at Yale Law School, one of the founding partners of Arnold Fortas and Porter, was an economist who was what they called institutionalist. The institutionalists were much closer to sociology in those days than to economics. And while he taught some economics at the Yale Law School, it had no influence. It didn't catch on. It was a one-time thing. And what happened at Chicago was ad hoc and unique. There was nothing prior to it in any sense, and it was accidental. After all, Aaron Director's being there was a result of the death of Henry Simons, this peculiar program that Hutchins had introduced at Chicago, and a strange story about Aaron Director. Well known, but Aaron Director, incidentally, was Milton Friedman's brother-in-law. He was Rose Friedman's brother, and was a student of Frank Knight, along with Milton and Rose and George Stigler. But he had a serious, serious problem. He had a writer's block. I mean, it's an unusual thing for a man as famous as he is in his field today, but he just could not produce, and he never produced a PhD. And that's why they wouldn't hire him in the economics department at the University of Chicago, even though many people said, this is the most brilliant man ever, you should hire him. They wouldn't do it because he didn't have a PhD. And it was a rigged deal to get him to the University of Chicago to put him in the law school. And it was, again, the accident that a space had opened with Simon's death that he came there.
At this time, were law professors expected to publish before they started teaching?
No. No, they were not. I think I had had one book review published before I started teaching. And a good record in law school was the sine qua non and almost sufficient. Clerkships for judges were not terribly significant either. They were all often desirable, but they were seen more as a way of getting in with the local bar and introducing yourself to law practice than academia.
Now, did law schools offer courses on financial regulation or securities at this time?
Almost none. This is the late 40s or early 50s. my guess, and I've never looked at historical material, my guess is that maybe Yale and Harvard and maybe Michigan would have had courses taught by an adjunct professor who was a practitioner in securities regulation, but I don't even know that that was true. At Chicago, they offered a course called securities regulation. It was very odd. It was a course in antitrust law, and it was a seminar on one case and one case alone. That was the U.S. v. J.P. Morgan and Company, which had been brought before World War II, suspended during the war, and resumed afterwards. And this man, Roscoe Steffen, who had been at Yale and moved to Chicago at that time, had been one of the government prosecutors in that case. Well, a large part of that case was amassing detail about the operation of the investment banking industry. And that's basically what we studied there. I wouldn't say I learned much law or economics, and indeed nothing about securities regulation. Mm-hmm. Now, I went to Yale the following year and was intrigued with the course. There was a very distinguished practitioner, Homer Kripke, who was also a very prolific author in the securities field and certainly one of the more thoughtful people in the field, who was teaching the course at Yale, and I took it, and it was strictly a bread and butter course. I mean, he taught it just as any a good bureaucrat would teach the rules of the particular laws that he was enforcing. There was no theory to it. There was no questioning. But Homer Kripke had come up in law at a time when that was unknown in law schools. Now, it was already being done at Yale and heavily being done at Chicago, more so than at Yale then, but not in Kripke's course.
Okay.
So it was my introduction to the difference between the 33 and the 34 Act and various periodic statements and so forth.
Okay. I'd like to ask you more about your time at Yale, but first just let me ask you one more question about the University of Chicago Law School. Do you recall that the professors there had a particular perspective on either financial regulation or the Securities and Exchange Commission? Oh, no. In other words, were they exceptionally critical of the agency?
No. If anything, if you had to characterize the political or ideological slant of the faculty at Chicago, it was very liberal.
Did that extend to people like Aaron Director?
Not Aaron Director. Aaron Director was a steel-minded devotee of free markets. Whether he had gotten that from Frank Knight or got it on his own, he was also acquainted, more than just acquainted, with Friedrich Hayek and Ludwig von Mises, who were the extremes, you might say, of free market advocates. So that Aaron's influence was not ideological. It was much more had to do with technique and approach. Certainly, one of the most famous pieces that came out while I was a student at Chicago was by Walter Blum and Harry Calvin, called The Uneasy Case for Progressive Taxation. Classic work of theoretical appraisal of an income tax. You can see a great deal of the influence of Aaron Director in that. And yet Calvin and Blum certainly weren't advocating repeal of the income tax. That's why it was an uneasy case. I think for Aaron it might have been an easy case. I came out of Chicago certainly influenced by Director. I even sat occasionally in the seminar that Friedrich Hayek gave there. I was already becoming aware of the idea, it was not well formed by any means, of free markets and private property as the basis for an ideology. I didn't have it yet then, by any means.
Mm-hmm. One question that I wanted to ask you a little bit earlier, it skipped over. Today, one of the major influences for libertarians is seen as Ayn Rand and her works. Had you read anything by her at this time?
No. I knew who she was. I had not read then. Subsequently, I did. her role in the development of the whole modern libertarian movement is very interesting. It is one dimension of that movement. It had almost no effect on me. I came at libertarian thought almost exclusively through ideas of economics and economic theory, principles. And I think stronger libertarians today have that kind of background. Not the first principle idea of Ayn Rand, where freedom of individuals is a starting point, not... point you reach in your reasoning.
Okay, so tell me a little bit about this graduate fellowship you had at Yale Law School. How did you get this fellowship?
Well, I was actually, it wasn't what I wanted. What I wanted was the Bigelow Fellowship at the University of Chicago, which was awarded me. There was only one problem. That was not a degree program, and I'd have been drafted immediately. And somehow I was really caught up in ideas and schooling at that point. I'd been very enthused about my time at Chicago, unlike my undergraduate work. So I wanted to continue. I knew that eventually I was going to have to go in service, but I wasn't sure when. And so I had to turn down the Bigelow Fellowship. I had applied for a fellowship at Yale, and that came through and gave me the deferment. So I went off to Yale. Before I went, I corresponded with Eugene Rostow, later the dean there, and probably at that point, probably the best known name in academic law in the field of antitrust, which is all I was interested in then. Corporations was a secondary but interesting area to me. And I wrote to Rostow, told him what I would like to do and that I would like to do some more economics. And he wrote back that, well, that's the Yale Law School. You can do all the courses you want as a graduate law student, courses in economics. So that was very much to my taste. So I went there and discovered a man named Myers McDougall, who was perhaps the most famous law professor, one of the more famous of the era, not most famous, but he and Harold Lasswell, the famous political scientist, had devised a schemata for using the social sciences to approach law. It was called Law, Science, and Policy. And all graduate students were required to immerse themselves in this, if you'll pardon me, garbage. I say garbage because I think there's only one rigorous social science, and that's economics. And law, science, and policy had no economics in it, whatever. What they thought they were doing, I don't know. Today, there are no remnants of it around. In those days, it was a big idea in legal education. And Laszlo and McDougall were demigods in that era. I hated it. From the beginning, it wasn't what I was interested in. Oh, McDougall was in charge of graduate students and wouldn't let me take the full list of economics courses that Rostow had already approved. Apparently, he and Rostow had a bitter fight in the Yale faculty meeting about me, and McDougall won. I was allowed to take one course each semester in economics. And the rest I had to do in the law school.
But you did take a full load of classes while you were
that
there.
That was you had to go through the master's degree program first, and if you did well in that, you were admitted to candidacy for the SJD. and as I say, I took the course in securities regulation. I took a course from Boris Bittger in taxation. I can't remember what it was. I think I took a course in arbitration. It was uninteresting to me. The school was not nearly as intellectually stimulating as Chicago, even though its reputation far exceeded that of Chicago in those days.
Homer Kripke later became more of a critic of the SEC than he perhaps was at this time. But you said that during his course he was not very critical.
Not only that, when I first started writing in the securities and corporate field, he was a critic of mine. But we were very friendly. I used to see Homer anytime I went to New York, and I honestly believe that I influenced him. In his very late writings, after he retired and was teaching at the University of San Diego Law School, you can see this reflected. He was an open-minded guy. As I said, he hadn't been imbued with the whole thing as part of ideology through law school because no law school in his era did that.
Do you think he stood out as a student in your classes for perhaps criticizing?
I don't think so. Huh? Not at Yale. I may have at Chicago.
So outside of your coursework, did you do any independent study while you were there?
Well, because of my dissatisfaction, really, with what developed as my program at Yale, I began doing considerable reading in areas, mainly I'd learned from Aaron Director, works of Hayek, whom I had met at Chicago, and Mises. I always used to joke that I was one of the few people in the world who probably sat down and read the whole of Human Action, Mises' great work on philosophy and economics, which later on you'll see plays a role in my development. I hadn't put all the pieces together by any means, but I was obviously very attracted to that writing even then. So in some ways I give Yale some credit that they probably would reject, but it was a valuable year, but not for reasons that they had anything to do with.
After graduating from Yale, or finishing at Yale, you practiced law briefly. Would you mind telling me what you did?
You left out an interesting episode of my life.
Okay.
I applied for and got a direct commission in Air Force J. And when I got the commission came through, it came through with a letter that said it would probably be 6 months before I would be called to active duty. So I went back to Chicago. Aaron Director and Ed Levy, who was then the dean, had gotten a big grant from the Ford Foundation for something called the Antitrust Study. It became monumentally important because it ultimately changed all of antitrust law. and I got back there at the right time with a letter from the Air Force saying I had at least 6 months, and I was hired as the first research associate on that project. 1 week later, I got a telegram from the Air Force to report for active duty in 24 hours. That was the end. Incidentally, the person who took my place on that project was Bob Bork, who later came to great fame by writing the book that summarized the antitrust study at Chicago.
Fascinating. So where did you serve in the Air Force?
Well, I didn't serve for long. I went in on this rush order, was in for 35 days when the Air Force came with a regulation that said if you were in a term enlistment, mine was 3 years, you either had to get out or go indefinite, which was a minimum of 5 years. Well, I checked with my Selective Service Board and found I couldn't be drafted because I had 1 day of more active duty during the Korean War, and so I got out. Started practice in Chicago, a firm that did some securities work. And a month after I was there, would you believe it, the Selective Service amended their regulations to require 60 days active duty, which I didn't have. And I got a 1A card. And after a lot of arguing in Washington about that, I was called back to active duty for 2 years.
Okay. And where did you serve then?
That was at McGuire Air Force Base in New Jersey. In some ways, two of the most valuable years of my life, because I was in court, in trial, almost every day of that period, which was a wonderful experience. Now, intellectually, it wasn't the area I was particularly interested in. It was criminal law, but it was a fascinating experience, and I think it always stood me in good stead, too. At least I could tell students I've tried several hundred cases, so it was good.
And what did you do after leaving the Air Force?
Well, at that point, I was invited back to the firm I had gone with in Chicago, but I wanted to start teaching, and frankly, with all this interruption, the Yale, the in and out of the Air Force, a year of practice, then back 2 years in the Air Force, I decided the hell with it. I would see if I could get a teaching job. And I did.
Where did you end up teaching?
At St. Louis University. Mm-hmm. Now, I had more important offers. I had an offer, and I accepted it, at the University of Virginia. And it was later withdrawn when they discovered that I was Jewish. And they made no bones about it. That was the reason the offer was withdrawn. The dean was slightly apologetic. He said it wasn't the faculty, it was the Board of Visitors. I was never completely sure of that. But they did withdraw the offer. And I remember I had an invitation from Boston University after I had the offer from St. Louis University. And I talked to Ed Levy about that. He said, Henry, he said, maybe you better take the St. Louis offer. He said, Boston U may already be at the point where they have too many Jews on the faculty. They had four. This was the beginning of the era of tremendous increase in the number of Jews in teaching and higher education generally. But law was almost the last holdout. I didn't realize that. There was no school I talked to at that time in which religion was not an issue. So I went to St. Louis University. I got terrified when Levy told me that. And I loved St. Louis University. It was a real university in the sense that they took education seriously. The president was a PhD from Chicago, a Jesuit, but he was much imbued with the Chicago style of things. And I had four very good years there.
You also taught at the University of Wisconsin for a few years.
Yeah, well, that was a visiting appointment that never resulted in a full appointment. It was a way station. I did teach antitrust, and that was always useful to me. But I don't think I wasn't teaching corporation law then because the dean was... well-known in that field.
And what year was it that you moved to George Washington University?
1962.
Okay, that was several
years. That was a critical year because I think the article that really first brought me to the world's, the small world's attention, I wrote mostly at St. Louis, but it was published after I moved to George Washington.
This was the Higher Criticism of the Modern Corporation.
That's right, in 1962 in Columbia Law Review.
What was the argument of that article?
Well, it wasn't so much an argument as an effort to do a comprehensive analysis from an economics perspective of the various theories of what we now call corporate governance. There had certainly some of it predated the New Deal, but a lot of it came out then. There were various theories around corporate democracy, that large corporations should be run like democratic states, was one idea. The notion that we now call corporate social responsibility was then had a number of different terms for it: corporate altruism, corporate social responsibility, corporate statesmanship. At any rate, I went into the literature of these various fields, plus the main paradigm of the day, the Burleian Means thesis of the separation of ownership and control, and their somewhat ambiguous suggestion for how to cure it. They never were very clear about that. At any rate, no one had ever done anything like that in the corporate area. No economist did. The business schools at the time were total dead letters as far as economics or anything intellectual was concerned. Here, this is exactly what I thought, you know, I should be doing. And I think I thought that it would bring me fame and fortune. And instead, it brought me calumny and hostility.
Burley himself responded to your article in the same issue of the journal in which it was published, which was the Columbia Law Review.
And thereby, I think, said to the world, this is important, even though I don't agree with any of it. Mm-hmm. Well, I would change one word of that. I don't think he understood one word of it. I met him several times. In fact, we had a kind of nice relationship. He tried to get me on the faculty at Columbia. Mm-hmm. He was that broad-minded a person.
Do you know what happened to prevent that from happening?
Yes, Bill Carey was on the faculty, later chairman of the SEC, and he absolutely stormed, would not allow it, this guy... The phrase I began to hear around that time was conservative kook. Now, you also have to understand that at about this time, the phrase Chicago economics was beginning to appear. Milton Friedman had made some popular inroads. Certainly, Director was not known popularly, but Chicago economics as a bastion of free market economics began to emerge, and it emerged not as something that people said, oh, this is important, and this is going to change the history of the world and anything else. This is evil. Evil conservative ideology. That's what was meant by the phrase Chicago economics. And that got attached to me, I would not say inaccurately, except that the characterization of the economics was all wrong. And so, as I say, instead of being met with success for writing something totally new and opening a whole new area of intellectual investigation, it's just the opposite.
Did you respond directly to this line of criticism?
Well, I couldn't do much. I was a young professor. I wasn't that confident in my economics at that point either. And although I got moral support from economics and from economists, including Milton Friedman, less so Aaron Director, who was always sort of cold and standoffish. He wouldn't enter the fray. he, at that point, I believe, had already retired to Stanford. But just before the 62 article, probably the seminal intellectual event in my life occurred. I was invited to a small conference for young professors at Claremont College, in which three very distinguished people held seminars for these young professors. One was John Jukes from Oxford, who had taken a very strong position against the British socialism then, the Labour government. Another was Felix Morley, who was a political opponent of Roosevelt during the New Deal, distinguished journalist and political theorist. And the third was a then somewhat young economist from UCLA by the name of Armin Alchin. I mentioned before that the von Mises I read at Yale in 1952 or 3 came back in the early 60s because Alchin began his seminar by reading a paragraph. It was a paragraph about property, and he asked if anyone in the group could identify it. I was the only one. I recognized immediately that that was from Mises' Human Action. And as he developed that first lecture, which became, I think, one of the most important economic articles of the 20th century, the Economics of Property Rights, it was like a light bulb went off in my head. It was incredible. All of a sudden, everything that I had done intellectually for, at that point, 13 years, came together with this one idea of Alchin's about the real nature of property rights and the Misesian notion of people making choices, every choice being a trade-off, every choice meaning there's a cost, that what you give away is the cost of what you get. And Alchin put that into terms of behavior explaining how people reacted in economic settings. But it was clearly applicable beyond what he was talking about. And I told him that I was teaching corporation law. I think I taught it 1 year then and was very interested in this sort of thing because no one had done anything like this. He said, well, you ought to take a look at, incidentally, after that first lecture, began a, that was 1957 or thereabout, began a 55 or 56 year friendship that is one of the major things in my life. Alchin's still alive. He's totally senile at this point. But at the break after that, I said to him, I said, you know, I still call him Professor Alchin then. I said, this is really what the lawyers have been looking for. Something that would explain why a given rule affects behavior in a certain way. And I said, only one thing. I said, please don't call it property rights, because if you do, you'll confuse the lawyers. Well, he wasn't concerned about that. He did call it property rights, and it's a subfield of economics today, the economics of property rights. That he invented and should have gotten the Nobel Prize for.
Was this in 1962?
No, that was 1957.
1957, this seminar. So this was before you started publishing some these later works.
57 or 58. Yeah, mentioned the corporations, and he put me on to another very important book that is less known than it ought to be, called An Economic Theory of Democracy by a man named Anthony Downs. Downs is a doctoral dissertation under Ken Arrow at Stanford, and it is actually the beginnings of the modern field of public choice theory. credit is usually given to Jim Buchanan and Gordon Tullock for a book called The Calculus of Consent. And in terms of addressing it as a new field, I think that's correct that they get the credit. But the sort of thing that Downs was doing was more helpful to me. He talked about a market for votes in the political arena. And it was just that very concept, which you see is also close to Alchin's concept that you can have property rights in anything you make decisions about, that gave me the idea that, well, we have votes in corporations. What's going on here? And eventually had me look and realize that we actually had a market in votes in corporations. Mm-hmm. Unlike the way we do it in politics, where we have a barter system, we exchange the vote for whatever the politician will give us. In corporations, we had a much more efficient system in which you could buy the share with the vote.
So this line of argumentation influenced your article, Theoretical Aspects of Share Vote. Would you say that?
That's a little later. Actually, in the 62 article, you will find all the subsequent arguments that I made in later writing. Some of it's buried in footnotes. Some of it's alluded to, but it's all there. And it all comes out of the intellectual experience of that period.
So after your article, The Higher Criticism, perhaps the next important article that we could talk about was Mergers and the Market for Corporate Control, which was published in 1964 in the Journal of Political Economy. Would you characterize this as your most influential article?
Easily. As I said, the ideas existed in the 62 article, but the law profession, including academia, simply couldn't understand that article. Burley didn't understand it. He's responding to something I didn't write. It's a response never. I've read it 100 times, and I can never quite grasp what it is he has in mind. But you have to realize how much alone I was in all of this. There was no, literally zero in the law side, anyone in any way sympathetic with what I was writing.
What was the argument of mergers in the market for corporate control?
Well, the simple argument was that the Burley and Means hypothesis that the separation of ownership and control, which is well documented, we know we use different terminology today, we talk about agency costs, but it was basically the idea that in large publicly held corporations, management was free of any real control by the so-called owners, the shareholders, and that Burley suggested that as a result, they misbehave, or at least can. That's part of the confusion, because at the end of the book, he says the only thing that's the saving grace of the corporate system is that these managers act right. They produce what they're supposed to produce. They don't take exorbitant salaries. At the margins, they're cheap, but by and large, the system is saved by the good faith of corporate directors. That's why he never had an enemy in the corporate sector in the United States, because he said nice things about them. It was inconsistent with the rest of the work, but at any rate, the idea caught on that there was something all wrong with these large corporations because there was no way of controlling the people who really controlled the companies. And I said, that can't be true. I said, there simply wouldn't be a gigantic stock market with people investing hundreds of billions, I don't think we had the word trillions yet then, of dollars, if the thing is going to be nothing but a scam cheating them over and over, which is what Burley suggested. And so this little piece, The Market for Corporate Control, explained the mechanism whereby the market provides the protection against the possibility that Burley had raised, and it was through having votes attached to shares, and there was an open market for shares so that you could go out and actually amass enough votes to take over control.
Now, did you see this line of argument as a complete substitute for the Burley and Means model, or was it something that could also exist alongside it?
At the time, I saw it as almost exclusive. I've come to think there are other devices. I mentioned some of the others in that article. Control of management, for instance, competitive markets and commodities will control managers because they can't control the prices of their inputs. Capital markets will control. The one I missed, and I'm really sorry, the bondholders have influence, considerable influence on corporations that aren't being well run. And I missed that one, but I had the others. And it was just that this was so new, and frankly, it was so exciting to have discovered this, that I may have overstated it, I'm not sure. At any rate, I stated it clearly enough that the law professors understood it. It was the first thing I had written that didn't get a hostile reaction at all. As a matter of fact, I would say the reaction was very good, and I think I know why. they saw me as, the enemy was as today, the enemy is corporate management. I don't know why they're such villains and demonized as they are. They aren't angels, but nonetheless. This was seen as an attack on managers by the left-leaning professoriate, that I was saying that, we've got this device to show these guys they better behave. And so they liked it. Mm-hmm. It fitted their ideology about corporations. that was all right with me. I didn't care. Mm-hmm.
So your article offers a certain view of investors. It basically says that investors will have an economic incentive to exercise control over the management of a corporation.
No, they will not. They won't even know. See, one of the great insights about markets, this comes out of Hayek and Mises, nobody has to know anything for markets to function absolutely perfectly. And that was true of the shareholders. They didn't have to know whether the managers were doing well or not. All they had to know was whether the price of their shares was as much as they wanted. If it was going up, they were happy. If it was going down, they were unhappy. If you're unhappy, what do? You sell your shares and put further pressure on the price until eventually someone says, oh, I can buy all these chairs very cheaply, take over the company, run it well, or put it in the hands of good managers, and make a pot. A lot full of money. And there was big payoff from this. Huge.
Right. Some people have also suggested that your article foreshadowed what's called the efficient capital market hypothesis.
Yeah, it did. that's funny because a couple of people, I guess, at the edges of that have gotten Nobel Prizes, and Eugene Fama, who is the namer of the efficient market hypothesis and this major proponent of it, I predated his work. To me, it just came out of theory. His work was entirely empirical, testing to see whether markets effectively responded to extraneous events. I said they had to. There was no other theory possible to explain market pricing other than something like this. I even offered in a footnote the basis of much of later theory on this, in which I said that all decisions in the stock market tend to be of a binaural type, a one or a zero, a yes or a no, and that error, therefore, cancels itself out. Because if it's complete error, it'll be error on the plus side as well as on the minus side, and what's left will be correct. That's a theory of the efficient market, and it was in that article. Occasionally, some people have noticed that I did that. I have great pride. Even earlier in the 62 article, I had a footnote in which I talked about votes having value, market value. And in the footnote, there was one case that was just so easy that someone with no mathematics background at all could still do it. You could show the before and after price of stocks and show that the difference could only be accounted for by the value of the vote in a control fight. That was the first empirical work anyone had ever done, an event study of the thing. Neither of those can I take credit for the great, tremendous amount of work that's going on since. But at least I anticipated them. I think they were simply consistent with a fully integrated theory of markets.
Yeah. So your next major work was in 1965, Insider Trading in the Stock Market. Tell me a little bit about writing this work. How long did it take you?
Maybe a year and a half. It started in class. Class was always a great stimulant to getting new ideas. We were talking about compensation and remembering some of Alchin's lessons, I realized that anything of value would be part of the total compensation that people would react to, not merely the part that was in cash. It could be longer vacations, it could be less hard work, it could be thicker carpets, or it could be valuable information. And as I thought about that, I said, well, you know, that makes perfectly good sense. That, incidentally, it hasn't empirically been established beyond a question now that the value of the information is part of the compensation package, or was when it was legal. And so I simply developed the notion from there. The class was very resistant to it. I realized very early that there was a psychological response to the idea that was strange. There was a woman who sat in the front row in the corporation's class who, after I gave a lecture one time on why insider trading might be a useful device, banged her fist on the desk and said, "I don't care what you say, it's just not fair." And that became the "it's just not fair" theory of insider trading. To this day, I've never fully worked out the degree of hostility, but I know that it's not economics. The economic argument's almost non-existent. I can go into that later if you want. Mm-hmm. But the thing that fuels the laws against insider trading have, as I said, almost nothing to do with economics and a great deal to do with human psychology. Mm-hmm. Why it's as strong as it is in that particular area, I'm not sure.
Do you think that your argument applied to all forms of insider trading or just actual trading by those inside the company?
No, it clearly the economics applies to everyone with valuable information. And incidentally, I was always at great pains to point out that my argument didn't apply in a case where contractually a person was obliged not to engage in insider trading, didn't apply to cases of fraud or manipulation or anything of the sort. But I was only talking about cases in which someone at that point legally came by the information and used it in the stock market. But quite clearly, this has been terribly misunderstood, and it's to your credit that you picked up on it. They thought I was talking only about the upper echelons of executives in the corporation. Come back to that. It's one of the recent articles I've written goes back to that point. But that was not what I was talking about. I was talking about what the role of economics is. Excuse me, what the role of information is in an efficient stock market, mm-hmm. And as it relates to a corporation. I've moved in my own thinking somewhat, not totally, but somewhat away from the idea of this as an incentivizing device for specifics. One of the illustrations I used in the book was the scientists in the labs of pharmaceutical companies who we know every morning before they got to work on their laboratory benches first dealt with their current findings for group investment in the stock market. They were not alone in that, but it was well known that they were doing that. And I think that was what misled me, that there was a very direct one-on-one incentive result nexus. I think now it's much more general. In this last paper I mentioned to you, I suggested that what it would do by allowing anyone to engage in insider trading is create a culture of innovation within a company. One of the great problems in theoretical writing about the economics of a corporation, how do you incentivize people to be innovative in a giant bureaucracy? And many people, including Joseph Schumpeter, one of the greatest economists ever, thought that it was impossible. He predicted that the large corporation would disappear because we couldn't properly incentivize people to be entrepreneurial in large companies. Today, I think that is perhaps a more important role for insider trading than what I originally identified.
Now, in this work, you seem to directly criticize several SEC officials. or at least you bring up the position of William Carey, who was the SEC chairman in the early 1960s. And as far as I can tell, this is the first time that you address the SEC directly in one of your works.
The word directly makes that correct. But if you go back to the 62 article, you pointed out that I really sort of invented the efficient market. If there's an efficient stock market, you don't need securities regulation. If the market works as efficiently as FAMA and others have proven it does, what in the world was all this regulation about? And you search in vain in the legal history of the securities laws to find any explanation of that. But this goes back to the other point that I was making to you, and why I'm perhaps kinder to the SEC today than I was 40 years ago. And that is that they just didn't have any conception that something like economic theory had any application to this. It was a totally foreign world to them. Now, part of it, I will say, relates to economics. We didn't have the economics in 1933 that would be necessary to understand securities markets. Hadn't been invented. Property rights theory hadn't been invented. Efficient markets hadn't been identified. The Coase theorem that plays some role in this, agency cost ideas, hadn't been invented. There was no way that people simply looking at this very complex mechanism of capitalism could understand it without these tools. And so, you know, I wish they had taken a more hands-off, more humble point of view, but humility was not what characterized the New Deal. Right. They all thought they had truth and that they could regulate perfection. Mm-hmm.
And how did they react to your book, the SEC?
Really bad. A colleague at the time was Manny Cohen, who was at that point, about that time, became chairman of the SEC. He knew what I was writing about. We had even talked about some. I can't remember the conversations. But he had agreed that when the book came out, that he would review it. Well, the book came out, and the next thing I knew, no one at the SEC would review the book, including Manny Cohen. And I was subsequently told that at that time there were meetings held at the SEC in which the decision was made that nobody on the staff could cite any work by me. I always cite it as one of my proudest accomplishments in life.
Wow.
My own bill of attainder.
If you don't mind me asking, where did you hear about this from? How did you find out that the SEC had done this?
You live in Washington. You know Washington is a sieve. I used to have people from the SEC come lecture to my class in securities regulation, and I'd hear it from them. Mm-hmm. You know, they were a very talky lot. I remember that. I was invited once, I think, with Roy Schottland, who authored the first response to the book on insider trading. It was fairly uninformed, but it was a decent work of criticism. Like most of the critics, it didn't rely on economics. It relied on morality and fairness arguments more than anything else. He and I were invited to debate this at the SEC, and although my recollection is very dim about it, people were very hostile to me at that time. They were not friendly at all. There was no collegial atmosphere as far as I was concerned.
Right. So in 1967, you wrote two other articles that continued your line of argument on the modern firm and about the financial regulation. The first was R2 Corporation Systems. Mm-hmm. And that seemed to offer a more comprehensive theory of the firm.
Actually, it was intended as an overview of a book that I planned to do, which later Dan Fischel and Frank Easterbrook in Chicago wrote. They give me credit for all the basic ideas, but they wrote the book on the economics of corporations, and I didn't. But that article allowed me really to catalog all the ideas about the economics of corporate governance that I'd been accumulating for quite some time. It was a very important article. It was also, oddly enough, somewhat well received by the academic community. Now, things were beginning to change at that point. I remember one episode. You have to remember, I'd been now in teaching 67 for 11 years, most of it with a feeling that somehow I was not part of the in group. At a meeting of the Association of American Law Schools, I remember I was starting up an escalator in a hotel, and there were two young professors I didn't know, had no idea who they were, except that I overheard that they were talking about me. And one of them said to the other one, "Oh, no, he's not a conservative kook. He's like Milton Friedman." At that point, I knew that the world had changed. If it had reached the level where, you know, Milton's popularity and influence was now resurrecting my reputation, it was of big importance. And so when the Virginia article came out on our two corporation systems, it was quite well received. I think it became standard for reading in courses in corporation law. But at about that point, I was really exasperated with law schools. As you can well imagine, even my own colleagues, with whom I always got along very well, had sort of the attitude, "Let's go twit Henry about economics." It was still a joke at most places. And at that point, I was offered a chair in political science and economics at the University of Rochester.
This was in 1968.
And I really wasn't very hesitant about accepting it. Mm-hmm. I really was ready to leave law schools. I was just so disgusted with it. I shouldn't have been. I was perhaps too impatient, but, you know, from my perspective, I'd been at that point doing this stuff for 12 years, and there was still no one in the law school world to whom I could talk intelligently about any of this. Mm-hmm. Not one person, not one.
Well, before we talk about your time at Rochester, let me ask you about one other article that you published around this time. It was entitled "Cash Tender Offers for Shares, a Reply to Chairman Cohen." Mm-hmm. That was also an attempt to enter into a political debate, as far as I can see.
Well, not exactly. The Williams Act had been presented in an extreme form as an antidote to these terrible hostile takeovers that were displacing these fine gentlemen who were running corporations, distinguished companies, with financial pirates who liquidated the company and did all kinds of terrible things. That was the argument and the level of argument. At any rate, Harrison Williams was a known crook. You know, he later went to jail for accepting a bribe, a sting by the FBI. But the worst crime he ever committed was drafting the Williams Act. That's probably cost the world's shareholders more trillions of dollars than we can count. Mm-hmm. Because it allows corporations to be more wasteful than they would otherwise be. I can't measure that, but I know it's huge. At any rate, when I saw that, the first version of that act, I could hardly believe it. Every line of it had something that contradicted intelligent economics. And that was the article that I wrote. Now, Manny Cohen was already on board defending this, because it was obviously being pushed by the Johnson administration. Johnson had close friends who were hurt by some hostile takeovers, and those guys play hardball. They weren't easygoing at all. At any rate, so that's the call for the title of the book, right, as a response to Chairman Cohen. I wanted to embarrass him, too. Mm-hmm. And I, I think it did. But then the hard politics continued. When the bill was revised considerably, and not in, I don't know in how much extent, because of my article, there were some parts of the original bill that were just embarrassing. They had to get rid of. But the bill, as it came through, they scheduled hearings in, I think it was 1967. And I expected to be called to testify. I was then in fairly frequent contact with a man named Stanley Reed, who published a journal of mergers and acquisitions. In fact, I think that journal is what gave the name to the field, M&A. He was a great fan of my writing and had summarized it in his own work in that magazine. He testified in the bill and invited me to come, but I wasn't invited to testify. And I was right there in Washington. I was a professor at GW then. After the testimony and the hearings, Reed went up to Senator Williams and said, "Look, why in the world wasn't Professor Manny invited to testify on this?" Said, "He's the only one who said anything interesting in this field." And Williams said, Manny, I never heard of him. So he turned to Manny Cohen and said, "Manny, I asked the SEC to give me the names of people who've been writing in the field." And Manny Cohen, who knew me very well, said, Manny, I said, "I don't know how we missed, sort of double talk."
Right.
And Reed let them have it. He got furious. We went down on the elevator together. Reed and I and Williams and Manny Cohen, I don't know who else, and Reed really let them have it. Mm-hmm. And he told them, he said, "Look, there have been 3 articles written on this subject, and 2 of them were written by Manny, and you said you didn't know it?" But it didn't make any difference. They didn't care. You couldn't embarrass those guys. They were playing for very, very big stakes.
So you were convinced that they left you off intentionally?
Oh, absolutely. No question about it.
All right. So
they didn't want any more publicity than they could possibly get.
Right.
To my arguments.
So, in 1968, you started teaching at the University of Rochester mm-hmm. in the political science department. One of the first articles you published after this time, though, was Insider Trading and the Law Professors in 1969. Was this sort of a parting shot against the legal profession?
It was perhaps the only time I ever really let my vituperation get into the articles. I was just
for the record. Can you just summarize quickly what the article said?
It was a point by point refutation from an economics perspective of what people like Mr. Ferber, who was the longtime solicitor of the SEC, and Roy Shotlin, and
who wrote a review of your book in 1967.
Yeah. And there was another famous article on the Harvard Law Review by corporation law professor that I can't remember his name now. I took them on and simply showed they didn't know what they were talking about.
Mm-hmm. Was there any response to this particular article, or did the matter just sort of fade away then?
Well, they never faded away. It hadn't faded away to this day. And it was a fight I knew I was in. I got sick of it at some point. You know, people used to, when insider trading was then becoming a very big topic, there were all kinds of conferences, and inevitably I'd be invited and sit there and hear this nonsense and have an audience of people who didn't have a clue of what I was talking about. So I quit accepting invitations to those conferences. I just got fed up with it. And I was sort of tired of insider trading, too. I thought I could leave the topic. I was never able to. As you know, up to last year, I've been writing articles about insider trading.
Right. Okay. To switch gears here just a little bit, by the late 1960s and early 1970s, you were starting to become a little bit more of a public intellectual, you might say.
That's right.
You were publishing.
About the period when I heard that famous statement, "He's not a conservative kook, he's like Milton Friedman."
Right.
Chicago economics, for that phrase ceased to be as pejorative for most people as it had been. It was recognized that Chicago economics was an important advance in economic theory and was very serious scholarship, and I got the benefits of that. Mm-hmm. Now, in that period, I had invitations to visit at Stanford and Yale, things that I had died for years before. But when the call came from later Judge Ralph Winter at Yale Law School, he said, "Henry, we've finally beaten back the Philistines, and we've decided to make you an offer." And I said, "Ralph, you're 2 weeks and 5 years too late." He said, "What do you mean?" I said, "Well, 2 weeks ago, I agreed to start this new center on law and economics." He said, "In 5 years?" I said, "And you're 5 years too late for me to give a damn." And that was exactly how I felt about it. Mm-hmm. In my early career, I knew I was writing the most important stuff in the field, and I couldn't get anywhere.
Now, as part of this increased public attention, during this period, you became a critic and an occasional debating partner of Ralph Nader. Mm-hmm. Would you mind telling me how that came about?
I can't recall how it originated. I do recall how it originated. It originated with his campaign GM and his total mischaracterization of large corporations and corporate governance. And I had written, I think I had written pieces in Barron's. I wrote quite a bit for Barron's in those days. And I'd be invited to debate with him on corporate governance, which was fine, but that mushroomed into broader matters, and which I didn't object to. It was Business Week, I think, had an article on me as the country's leading critic of Ralph Nader. Well, that made my speaking fees go way up to levels I should have been at years before. Mm-hmm. Ralph was a formidable debater, no question about that. In the first debate we had, I didn't know what to expect. He mopped up the floor with me because I couldn't make any single argument because he had such a scattergun approach. Everything was wrong, and everything raised all sorts of different economic issues, and I'd try and address it, fall apart. And so I learned you had to zero in on one thing and hold him to it. And then I became a much more effective debater. I once had occasion to counsel Ronald Reagan on that point. He was debating with Nader at the American Enterprise Institute.
Do you remember what year this was?
It must have been 68 or 69. And I knew the people at AEI then. I'd done a book for them. Incidentally, a very important book called Economics of Securities Regulations. It's the first time anyone ever publicly announced that economics had anything to do with securities regulation. At any rate, I simply told Reagan what I just recounted to you. He was very good. He had no trouble dealing with Nader in debate. But I continued to have association with Nader for years after that. I remember students when I was dean at George Mason came in very hesitant because they wanted a big name for some conference or debate or speaker, and they knew that I had had some connection with Ralph Nader. And I said, "Sure, I'll get him for you." And I picked up the phone and promised him a microbiotic lunch, and he came, and all the students were very impressed by that.
So in the 1970s, you also began a series of summer workshops. One of these series was on economics for lawyers. Would you tell me briefly where this idea came from?
I had gone to the University of Rochester with two titles, one an academic title and one an administrative one, to be director of planning for a new law school. That law school eventually became the George Mason Law School. I had previously been a consultant to the president and had written a monograph on what I thought legal education should look like. Incidentally, a subject I'm writing on as we speak. The He was very impressed with it, and that was part of why he invited me to Rochester. It was clear from the get-go that there was going to be financial problems with getting money for a new law school. But as part of the preparation, I advanced the idea that it would be good for Rochester to have some contact with the law school world. I wanted to do this program for personal reasons. As I've told you several times, for years I'd been out there with no one in the law school world who had a clue of what I was talking about. I could talk to Armin Halchin, Milton Friedman, Aaron Director, Ronald Coase I knew by then, others, economists, but not the lawyers. So I got the idea that I'll make people be able to read what I wrote. And that was part of my idea in doing this. And part of it was to establish Rochester. But it developed a life of its own. It was so successful, from the word go, it was successful, that eventually out of that grew the Law and Economics Center and the development of the whole field of law and economics. Mm-hmm. So I give the SEC some credit for that. Their failure to understand any economics goaded me into economics education.
You also later started a series of summer workshops on economics for federal judges. Mm-hmm. Did you ever think about starting a series for people from the SEC?
Yeah, we did. We actually had three programs. The first one we did was for staff members of members of Congress.
Do you remember what year this was?
Probably would have been about 1977. Probably, maybe 78. At any rate, they didn't take it seriously. The people were playing and they just were not serious and the program was not a success. But we still had the idea of educating government people. So we said, maybe if we took a particular area and got people from all over the government, not just the staff, congressional staff people, that it would go better. And for whatever reason, we decided not to do securities regulation. We did health economics. And for 2 years, we ran this program in economics for government health care officials, and it was enormously successful. Mm-hmm. And then we couldn't get money for it. The pharmaceutical companies wouldn't touch it. They were terrified. You know, they live a political life, and this is scary, so they don't do things like that. The big health foundations wouldn't give us money, and so we dropped it. I later had an undersecretary of health, education, and welfare tell me that something he learned in that program changed one provision in a federal health bill that he estimated saved the taxpayers $500 million. I said, boy, if markets worked, I'd get some of that for more programs, but that wasn't an area that markets worked in.
Okay. So creating the GMU Law School, this is something that you've written an article about. Perhaps we won't go into too much detail about it, but would you tell me briefly about that process?
Well, it really began with Rochester. Now, at Rochester, I had proposed overly ambitious program of having intellectual tracks in a law school so that a law student would major in economics, psychology, history, technology. Those are the main four, I think. Maybe finance was another one. Eventually, I realized you couldn't do more than one of those in a startup law school, certainly. Maybe a very rich law school could do them all. So I had this book on what a modern law school should look like that I've been carrying around with me for 12 years at that point. When I was first called about the deanship at Mason, now they had recently bought a very bad law school. It had just barely become accredited, but it shouldn't have been. And when they called me from the university, my friends Jim Buchanan and Gordon Tullock were at Mason then, And I said, look, there's no reason to think that I could do anything with an existing law school. If I could start a new one, be fine. And they asked me if I would come up and talk to the president about law schools, because he wanted a law school. So I did, and he was a very good salesman. He liked the proposal I had. He was not a profound man, but he had a very real public relations sense. He sensed that this would be something different, and he wanted that in his law school. So he sold me. He committed enough money that I could buy out a lot of the existing faculty and fire those that didn't have tenure. And I did. I got rid of 14 people in 1 year and hired 11 new people. 25 personnel actions without a single faculty meeting.
Wow.
Nothing like that has ever happened in the history of higher education. But by the second year, we were already an important law school and embarked on implementing the Rochester program at Mason.
What would you say has been the contribution of this law school, either to the field of law and economics or to the study of financial regulation
enormous,
more broadly?
Enormous. First of all, it's had big, big influence on legal education because other schools began to see that it didn't broaden legal education beyond the black letter law stuff that most people were doing or what was then becoming even more serious problem, heavy ideological radicalism, that we're going to have some real problems. For one thing, we could count the number of law and economics people that William & Mary, Georgetown, American University, and George Washington hired after I started this program at George Mason. So we had an immediate effect there. The idea of specialization in law school, professional specialization, certainly got kick-started. It's a very expensive way to implement with the existing required system of legal education, but more and more schools are doing it. It also, it caught the coattails of the rising influence of law and economics. The Law and Economics Center, which started at Miami, had really been successful in establishing this as very serious intellectual work. Not many people before that realized that it was. That caught on very much. I think the judges program you mentioned had something to do with this. Certainly the law professors program had a lot to do with it. And then the existence of a whole law school built around that paradigm had a lot to do with it. And I think it was mutual. That was part of the reason for the success of George Mason. And George Mason, in turn, had influence on the growth of law and economics. Today, it's a powerhouse.
Mm-hmm. Do you know whether many graduates from that law school have gone on to serve in the SEC?
Yes, quite a few have, including two commissioners. And more important, some of the staff people in Congress who oversee the SEC. I was recently invited to testify on the use of cost-benefit analysis in securities regulation, and I learned subsequently that the staff director of that was a graduate of George Mason Law School, and he had learned the lessons that I wanted him to learn. So it's having a considerable influence in Washington. Now, it's not alone. There have been a number of factors. The development of the Mercatus Center at George Mason has, I think, been very important. The think tanks like Cato, AEI, Heritage have all become a lot more legitimate, a lot more intellectual than they used to be. I once wrote a piece for Forbes as to why conservatives shouldn't fear Obama as much as they did Roosevelt. And one of the differences was that in 1932, there was no intellectual opposition. It didn't exist. There was ideological opposition, but not intellectual. No university specialized in microeconomics and price theory. The idea of economics of property rights was unknown. Economics was really quite primitive then. And then I pointed out that now we have a large intellectual force. You have these think tanks, you have journals, you have books. It's a different intellectual world today than it was back then. Mm-hmm.
Just to go back a little bit, in 1981, the Reagan administration took office, which meant that for the first time in many years, you had an administration with a limited government philosophy that had come into power. Now, did you see this manifested in regards to financial regulation?
I didn't. I wasn't paying close attention to it either. In 1980, really start of 81, I had moved the Law and Economics Center to Emory. If you recall, the economy was taking its corrective recession then. Money was very hard to raise, unlike what it had been when I first started the Law and Economics Center. And so I was really working hard to keep it going then. I wasn't teaching then, so I wasn't paying a lot of attention to the securities field at all in those years.
Hostile takeovers and insider trading were both very hot issues during this period. Were you invited to testify before the Congress?
No, I don't think I ever was on either subject.
Okay.
I don't know that there were ever any hearings on insider trading. Maybe before the, 87 Act, there may have been hearings, but I wasn't invited. But they would have been highly technical. They didn't go to the fundamentals of it anyway. The history of the whole insider trading thing is weird. From the beginning, it was weird. Never went through normal lawmaking regulation, rulemaking procedures. The jurisprudence of it is just bizarre. Mm-hmm. How the law emerged in a funny way without anyone with authority ever making the law, and the courts, I think accidentally, stumbling into accepting it as law. The Supreme Court getting the Texas Gulf Sulphur case, which they decided on a technicality and never addressed the central issue at all, but people took that as acceptance of the law. To this day, I think it's grossly unconstitutional law.
And during this this time in the 1980s, you also publicly defended some who had been convicted of insider trading, such as Michael Milken.
Michael Milken. That was a replay of a gross miscarriage of justice that happened early in the history of hostile takeovers. The guy who invented hostile takeovers was a man named Louis Wolfson. He was a crude former professional boxer. And he sort of stumbled into this. I later met him. He never had any understanding of the implications of takeovers, but he understood how to make money. And he pioneered the thing. He worked out a lot of the different angles of the early hostile takeovers. In the course of this, quite naturally, Wolfson made some big, big, powerful enemies, including, I believe, people in the Johnson administration. And he was tried in about as bad a trumped-up Soviet-style criminal case as we ever had. They even were able to select the judge who had been the man who wrote all the mythology about securities regulation, Pecora, in the famous Pecora hearings, who is now a district judge in New York. He tried the case, and they sent Wolfson to jail for an incredibly minor technical violation. Again, never should have been tried as a criminal case because the rule had not even developed on the civil side yet. But at any rate, they convicted him. He went to jail. When he got out of jail, he sold all financial interests completely. He said he never wanted to have to deal with the SEC again. Got into thoroughbred horse racing and had two Kentucky Derby winners and owned a firm, the last Triple Crown winner.
Wow.
He was a rough and tumble guy. Mm-hmm. That was reprised, not with all the same bells and whistles, with Michael Milken in what was called an insider trading scandal. Nothing that Milken was alleged to have done involved insider trading. I mean, the only thing I could ever see that he ever did that was wrong was a kind of payoff to a mutual fund manager to buy some shares, but that was a common practice.
Yeah.
The other stuff was all sham. But if I don't know if you can remember, the world was in one of its panic states of hysteria about finance then, and it was clear heads had to roll. Now you had Boesky, who was a clear crook. I mean, he was paying cash money to young lawyers to get information out of law firms. I never condoned that. And he was engaged in insider trading, so-called parking of shares and things of that sort. Milken was also played hardball, I'm sure. But I don't think he did anything very wrong, and certainly nothing deserving of prison.
Mm-hmm. Now, in 1987, after John Shadd announced...
At that time, I debated Ralph Giuliani. It was Giuliani who sent Milken to jail and was the star of the day at sending these guys to jail and handcuffing brokers. Who
Tell me about that debate.
Were later tested. It was astounding. I left it and I shook my head. I said I didn't know there were still people around who were so totally ignorant of this field. The man knew nothing, absolutely nothing. He wasn't even profound about the law, but as for any understanding of what he was involved with, it was 100% missing. And it was not friendly.
Mm-hmm.
Always suspicious of him later. I must say I came around to thinking politically he got himself on the right track, but I was always very uneasy about this guy because I like people who understand what they're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And he did not. I would say it wasn't NYU, it was a securities law group in New York. I would say that for a considerable part of that audience, I won. Because things were beginning to be different in those years, the early years.
And perhaps another side of that was in 1987, when the Wall Street Journal, in an op-ed, mentioned your name as a possible candidate for the SEC chairmanship.
Yeah.
Do you think there was any serious consideration of this?
I don't think so. I think it was tongue-in-cheek from the Wall Street Journal. I have good friends there, and they knew that that was about as impossible as landing a man on Mars next year.
So a leitmotif of your work is the role of economics and securities legislation. From your perspective, how has the SEC dealt with this issue?
Well, from the beginning, when I really first began my writing, it was almost disbelief. There's a strong community of securities lawyers based on work with and in the Securities and Exchange Commission. They have their own culture. They have their own set of beliefs. And I was so far outside of that. This was so strange to them that it was almost like not a foreign language, but a hostile foreign culture attempting to invade. I was talking about their area, but in a way they didn't understand. Certainly the intellectual leader of that crowd in those years was Louis Loss, a professor at Harvard Law School and the author of a 6-volume treatise on securities regulation, which I must repeat, one of my most famous bon mots. Louis Loss did one of the great tour de forces of all times. He wrote a 6-volume treatise without a single thought in it. That's perhaps unfair, but perhaps not. How can you write about 6 volumes about securities regulation and not once ask anything about the economics of markets, finance, exchange, price, any of those things. He just assumed that he knew all the answers to those questions, if they entered his mind at all. That was the mindset of the SEC. And that's why when a book came out on the economics of insider trading, they were hostile, but it was mainly because they thought it was a joke. They didn't take it seriously. They couldn't. There was nothing in their background that would allow them to take it seriously. That's why I say I'm kinder in my thinking about them today than I used to be. Mm-hmm. Now, there's been a big change. Part of it is the change I mentioned with the role of Milton Friedman in modern thought. Part of it has been the success of law and economics. After all, none of the young lawyers going to the SEC today come out of law schools where they haven't heard of or had a course in law and economics. 40 years ago, that would have been unheard of completely. So that they're a little bit more susceptible to it. In the recent hearings on cost-benefit analysis and securities regulation...
This was in April of this year.
April of this year, 2012. The SEC came out with a surprise statement by their general counsel and... I forget which division, requiring that they always use cost-benefit analysis in rulemaking. And the first sentence says, they've always done that. Well, they've never done that. I don't know whether that sentence signified that they were sort of being disingenuous or that they still don't know what cost-benefit analysis really is. But it's a big advance. Big step forward.
Mm-hmm. And your testimony to Congress was actually relatively positive about the SEC's...
When I saw that, I was in a state of disbelief. Now, I later learned that they didn't want to publish it. They didn't want to publicize that they had written it. And the House committee, in effect, pressured them so that it is published now. Whether it has any effect on law, I think it might because of some recent opinions in the D.C. Court of Appeals on the use of cost-benefit analysis in rulemaking. I think this may be absorbed into the rules the SEC has to live by. Mm-hmm. And if it is, it really is a revolutionary change. Mm-hmm.
You followed up your testimony with an article in Regulation Magazine that argued that the requirement that new regulations come with a cost-benefit analysis is salutary. In your view, has the SEC turned the corner?
I don't know the answer to that. If they've turned the corner, it's a very slight turn. It's nothing that they think of as revolutionary. It's nothing that has entered their day-to-day discourse any different than it was 5 years ago. But it is there. And I'm optimistic it may make a difference.
Well, that's a great note to end on. Professor Henry Manny, thank you very much for talking with me today.
Thank you.